Welcome to the 2014 Swarthmore Lecture. Usually, the Swarthmore Lecture is introduced by the previous year's lecturer. Last year's lecture was given by our friend Gerald Hewitson, and you may observe that I am not he. Gerald would have loved to have been here, and he sends his greetings. But this weekend he has a higher priority, which is to be at his daughter Sian's wedding celebration. I'm Helen Rowlands, Head of Education at Woodbrook Quaker Study Centre. Woodbrook is responsible for the Swarthmore Lecture, which has been given at the time of Britain Yearly Meeting every year bar one since 1908. The purpose of this public lecture is to explore and interpret the life and beliefs and witness of the Religious Society of Friends, both to ourselves and to the wider world. There is a lecture committee, which is appointed by and responsible to the Woodbrook trustees. The committee seeks to discern topics and lecturers which will be relevant to the life of our yearly meeting, and it makes decisions 2 to 3 years in advance so as to give lecturers plenty of time to prepare. Friends at large are invited to contribute to the discernment of future lectures, and there is information about how you can do this on the Woodbrook website. Traditionally, lecturers have been asked to write a book, which has often been more substantial than the spoken lecture. This is not now the only way we approach things, and the committee discusses with each lecturer what media they want to work with and what additional events or materials will help others to engage with their work most helpfully. This year's lecture is to be given by my colleague Ben Pink Dandelion, and it is accompanied by a more extensive book, which will be on sale at the rise of the lecture and later in the Quaker bookshop. It's also available in a Kindle edition. An audio version of the lecture will be available from this evening on the Woodbrook website, and a video will follow in a couple of weeks or so. Tomorrow, you can meet Ben for a question and answer session between 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the large marquee. Details of that are in your events listing. Ben will also be co-leading a Woodbrook weekend course next July called A New Vision for the Quaker Way, which will be an opportunity to build on the themes of this lecture. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to me to have worked with Ben as a colleague and a friend for over 20 years. Ben is now program leader for the Centre for Postgraduate Quaker Studies at Woodbrook, and he's an honorary professor in the University of Birmingham. His own doctoral research was to undertake the first major sociological investigation of modern British Quakers, which was published as a sociological analysis of the theology of Quakers, The Silent Revolution. He put forward the idea of a behavioural creed in which it is possible for open liberal beliefs to coexist alongside small c conservative behavioural culture in our Quaker society. Some of you may have participated recently in a variant on his original research questionnaire, which has been run this year for the third time. And this is beginning to build longitudinal insights into how things are changing among us over time. Growing from this work, Ben has almost single-handedly built a new academic discipline of Quaker studies. He has published extensively, making a really significant contribution to scholarship. He is in demand as a speaker and a lecturer, particularly among North American friends. His students value him as a gifted and deeply committed and conscientious teacher and research supervisor. And his colleagues appreciate his wisdom and his deep reservoir of humor and fun. But Ben is no ivory tower academic. He has written elsewhere about his own experience of spiritual convincement. Like many of us, he wrestles with the implications of his faith for the way he lives his life. Not ducking questions about the ways his own living is and isn't congruous with his convictions. He strives to live simply, in humility, faithful to his calling. And he's even become pretty good at resisting the siren call of the vintage Bentley motor car and the lure of the powerful motorbike. Today, Ben is going to speak to us under the title Open for Transformation, Being a Quaker. He will speak to us out of the stillness of our worship. And at the end, we will return into the silence, without applause and without questions or discussion. There's opportunity for that tomorrow. Ben and I we'll close the session by shaking hands. Open for transformation, being Quaker.
Well, thank you, Helen. Helen's a very experienced and gifted facilitator, so she was wise enough not to say, "And Ben will begin when he's ready." That may have taken a little longer to get going. And I did hear from one Swarthmore lecturer that they got to this point and they were very pleased to realize that they had every word that they were going to say typed down in front of them. Well, I just have what my daughter Florence called some indecipherable handwriting here. So we'll just have to see how we go. There may be hesitation, and there may be repetition, and there may even be deviation. We'll see. So. Okay. Well, here we are in the third year of a yearly meeting exercise on what it means to be a Quaker. And to the outsider, this may seem a rather curious kind of exercise. Partly, I suppose, we might say, well, being a Quaker isn't really what it's all about. Quakerism is a vehicle for our faith journey. And so what's more important is the faith journey itself rather than what the mechanics of Quakerism entails. However, of course, if we want our faith to be dynamic and coherent and cohesive, then it would be sensible to be in the same place regarding Quakerism and what it means to be a Quaker. And so that leads to another kind of question an outsider might ask is, well, don't you know? Don't 20,000 of us, part of an organization that's been around nearly 370 years, know what it means to be part of that organization? Well, maybe we're not very clear, actually. Maybe we're a little bit fuzzy. Perhaps in the last couple of decades, we've shown a slight lack of clarity or confidence in our ability to say what Quakerism is and to communicate that both amongst ourselves and those who come to us and to the outside world. I meant to bring a Quaker Faith and Practice to WAVE, so this will be the Quaker Faith and Practice. It's actually all in here. At the beginning of chapter 11, it even lists what the fundamental elements of being a Quaker are. So why might we need an exercise on what it means to be a Quaker? But as I'll hope to explain, there's a gap between our red book and how we are amongst ourselves. And I'll be looking at some of the ways in which that gap may have evolved in recent years. So I want to do three things this afternoon. One is I want to say what I think it is, what it means to be a Quaker. Secondly, I'd like to look at some of the challenges we face. And thirdly, I want to offer some suggestions for sort of rekindling and reclaiming a strong sense of corporate Quaker identity. Okay. Good. Okay, what does it mean to be a Quaker? Well, I think there are four, what I've called core insights that we can identify historically and indeed globally amongst friends. The first is that we discovered way back in 1647 that we can encounter the divine directly, that we don't need a text to mediate, and we don't need a separated priesthood. As we heard this morning, we're all part of the royal priesthood, all ministers. And we can encounter the divine together without any outward forms. Secondly, that we have then necessarily developed ways to interpret that experience of encounter, that spiritual experience, that we've wanted to both understand what that experience is saying to us and also check when that experience is authentic and when it may be something coming out of our imagination. So we've developed systems of discernment, and discernment is absolutely central to us as friends. And this would include our Quaker business method. Thirdly, we've needed to develop forms of worship that nurture that experience of encounter. And for us in Britain, we've maintained a system of stillness and silence, our understanding and our experience that absence leads to a sense of presence. And fourthly, that we've had a persistent imperative, if you like, to lead a particular kind of life coming out of this experience of encounter that we, over the centuries, have campaigned against war and against social injustice, that we try to lead our lives in line with our callings, what we would call our testimony, the life we have to lead, the life we're called to. So I think that's a nice short list. That's four things. We might want to abbreviate it in terms of sort of worship, encounter, discernment, and testimony. Four core insights that underpin what it means to be a Quaker, that allow us to approach the sort of magic and mystery of the life of faith. There's a few things I'd like to say about that list, however. The first is that, as you'll see, the focus there is on process, not on detailed theology. Now, there is a theological underpinning to all of those aspects. We're not just sitting there doing nothing. We're sitting there because something happens for us in the silence and stillness. Something happens in our Quaker business meetings. We can discern, and we do live in line with our leadings. So there are some theological assumptions there. Our whole Quaker life is rooted in spirituality. But also, that list reflects the idea that words aren't necessarily very helpful, or trying to over-define the divine is not really appropriate or a helpful use of time. And there's a lovely article by Harvey Gilman in this week's Friend on the nature of religious language. And he was asking whether ultimate truth can ever really be expressed in words. The words don't quite match. And we understand that very well. So silence both is our medium, our approach to the divine, but it's also often the best response in some ways, theologically. The second thing about that list of four core insights is that I think they're inherently collective. In other words, that we do things together. We worship together, we discern together, we act in the world together. I'm sorry, my earring keeps attaching the microphone and I get excited. So. I did think we wanted kettle drums, really. I've often thought that, Quaker faith is, really summed up by kettle drums. We could have, these like boom, 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 I mean, it's fascinating. It's a wonderful list of encounter and, discernment and testimony. Boom, boom. I mean, obviously, we'd have them quietly and they'd, sort of silent kettle drums. And but, you sort of hear them on the inside. So, it's inherently collective. Early friends did not have God breaking into their lives just to say, oh, well, that's great, I'm saved, I'll go back to the farm, thank you very much. Instead, they were drawn to follow the movement, bound in by their experience. So the Yorkshire Seekers moved to Westmorland, and the Westmorland, Seekers gathered, and then in 1654... ministers and elders spread out across England and Wales. It was a highly itinerant movement following the callings of God. Francis Haugill speaks of being gathered in a net, of finding of knowing a place to stand in and what to wait in, being bound together in a covenantal relationship, a sort of mutual, open-ended dynamic with the divine, in which we're bound in and gathered and enfolded and accompanied. Quakerism is not a DIY religion, as we so often hear. It's a DIT one, a do-it-together kind of faith. And we need to remember that. It runs through all we do. The third thing I want to say about this list is that we can't encounter the divine and not be changed by that experience. Our processes are inherently transformative. It may come in little nudges, or there may be some magical kind of major breakthrough moment. But that moment of conviction that we heard about this morning is about transformation. It's about being changed. It's about seeing and feeling the world in a new way. It may be uncomfortable. It may mean leaving things that we love and desire behind. It may mean not having a Bentley anymore. However, but it leads us into a new and stronger place, a more spiritually authentic place, and where we are, again, not alone, because we're with each other. There's this awful thing, and I think we heard an echo of it this morning, saying, well, I can't be a Quaker because I'm not good enough. But actually, we're Quakers because we're not good enough, and we need each other to support each other through our journey of faith. We are transformed individually and collectively in order to become agents of transformation in the world. That's what it means to be a Quaker. However, we have become a little fuzzy in places. In times we've got ourselves into a little bit of a pickle, I think. And we can look back over the last 150 years for some clues. In that time, we have recast our Quaker tradition to be a far more permissive kind of Quakerism. Britain Yearly Meeting is part of liberal Quakerism. And we're one of the most liberal or permissive yearly meetings within the liberal tradition, which makes us one of the most permissive yearly meetings in the world today. And we've recast our Quakerism at the same time that society itself, wider society, has itself been changing and is today, you know, far more individualistic than it was, say, a century ago, and also far more secular. Sociologists of religion talk about a process of secularization, of faith losing its public voice, of individuals losing their interest in the spiritual, where the religious may no longer be the first resort and not necessarily the last, that there's other ways that we manage our lives and understand ourselves. And I think in places and at times, within our religious society of friends in Britain, we've been infected and affected by both of those trends, individualism and secularization. And I want to look at some of the consequences of this in two areas. The first is in terms of belonging, and the second is in terms of believing. Well, the way we belong to our yearly meeting changed dramatically in the middle of the 19th century. It's around that time that we discovered that we were no longer the true church. Okay? This is a very dramatic moment. I mean, it wasn't just a moment, but it's a dramatic shift for us as a society. It meant that we no longer needed to save everybody and be there for everyone. What we realized around that time is that we were part of the true church, part of true Christianity. And that raised certain questions. Why then were we as Quakers still wearing the plain dress? Why did, as one friend said, why did our spiritual journey need to start in the tailor's shop? If, after all, we're only part of the true church, the Anglican was okay, they didn't need to get all dressed up. We needed to dress up and we needed to speak differently from the rest of the world and use thee and thou rather than you. So, well, those things started to disappear. There were various reforms in the 1850s and 1860s that basically undid our peculiarity or particularity as a people of God. And we've been increasingly allowed to do more and more of what we decide is Quaker. After 1859, we could marry a non-Quaker and not be disowned. So in fact, we could, after 1861, we could leave our meeting house, walk out into the street not dressed in plain Quaker dress, not using the plain Quaker language, and go home to a Methodist spouse. It's a significant change in the way that we identified as Quaker. And it's led into the 20th century into the possibility of the private life, that we no longer actually have unexpected visits by elders coming to check up on us. We're probably very pleased about that. You know, what would we hide? You don't need to share. It's okay. So we enjoy our freedom. But it also, and it means that really our sense of being accountable to the Quaker meeting stops at the meeting house door. And often when people feel they've been unsupported during times of crisis, it may just be that our meetings haven't known how far they can enter into our life outside the meeting house. In other words, we've lost a sense of being accountable to our meetings. And we have this private life, or the possibility of a private life. We have huge freedoms, and we have the responsibility to decide what is and is not Quaker. Then things went a bit further, though, because I talked a moment ago about, well, not feeling we had to save everybody. Well, we hardly hear about salvation in British Quakerism now. Saved from what and for what? So we moved, actually, we've moved in the 20th century from being part of the true church, part of true Christianity, to actually be seeing ourselves as one faith amongst many or none. And I suggest that we would think that we wouldn't say that it was vital for anyone to be part of any faith now. We're that permissive. We obviously think it's a good thing. We're here for a week. But we don't think it's essential that everyone must be part of a faith. And in that sense, we present ourselves as an option within the option of faith. And that, I think, has had consequences for us in terms of how we belong to the yearly meeting or belong to our local meetings. Well, the first major change, and this is probably related to the fact we could start marrying non-Quakers, is that we've seen the breakdown of what we might call dynastic Quakerism. In the 20th century, we're no longer all born into Quaker families and brought up on monthly meeting teas and learning our Quakerism over the dining table. 87% of us, according to last year's British Quaker survey, have joined as adults. So, and where we do have children who are part of our Quaker meetings, if they don't want to go to Quaker meeting, and it may be that now only one parent is a Quaker, and or even the only Quaker in their household, and if the children don't want to go to Quaker meeting, then we may very well say, well, that's okay, because it's only an option. Florence, don't listen to this bit, okay? You know, we're going to meeting. So, okay. A smaller proportion of us attend meeting every week than we did, say, 100 years ago. About a third of us, a third of the people on our members and attenders list are likely to turn up at meeting on any one week. It may be that we go to the Anglican Church if or if not they have a family service, or it might be we'd be tempted by the motorcycle club on some Sundays. It's okay. So, you know. But we are going to meeting, Florence. So. So even our attendance is more optional than it used to be. In terms of service, we've made that optional. And it was startling for me a few years ago to meet friends who remembered the days when nominations committee asked you to accept a nomination, you of course automatically said yes. Who were you as the individual to challenge the discernment of the gathered group? Well, actually, we've got very good at saying no now. It may be we're being asked to do more, but actually, we regularly say no to nominations committees. And there's some startling statistics about how many people Central Nominations Committee needs to ask to fill any one role. Or to fill any one committee. There's also fewer of us giving money to the yearly meeting. So maybe that's optional as well. Maybe we're putting our money somewhere else. But what the picture I'm trying to build up is that we have a very optional sense of belonging. We heard this morning about how we've also blurred the lines over the last 50 years between what's a member and what's an attender. I joined about 30 years ago because I wanted to attend business meeting. And you needed to be a member to go to business meeting. You needed to be a member to hold office. And it was generally members who gave financially. So, well, we've blurred all those lines, and it's not surprising then that we have the kind of session we do this morning about, well, what is it to be part of our society? The category member and attender become less clear. We are, in a sense, a more diffuse community. So let's think about belief for a while, because this is the other area where I think we've become prey to some of the individualization and secularization of wider society. Well, the young friends who really pioneered liberal Quakerism were very keen to emphasize that it was spiritual experience that should be primary. And we very much feel that today. How do we know what is of God? Is a really important question for any religious group. And our response is, well, we know in our spiritual experience what is of God. Belief then becomes an interpretation of that experience, a sort of a belief story. And it becomes private or marginal within a group that emphasizes experience more than doctrine. In fact, it was in 1922, in the revision of the Book of Discipline then, that the section on Christian doctrine was replaced by a section called Illustrative Spiritual Experiences of Friends. And the red book, which I failed to bring, is largely now Illustrative Spiritual Experiences of Friends. As early as 1930, the question is then raised, well, if it's about spiritual experience, do you need to be a Christian to be a Quaker? And in 1966, draft membership regulations that were presented to the yearly meeting were rejected as sounding too doctrinally Christian. As I say, belief has become privatized and individualized. We've also developed a doctrine of believing that none of us will actually get to the whole truth. Even together, we won't quite get there. We're on a spiritual journey collectively. All of our theologizing, all of our interpretation is towards, or perhaps it's never going to match the ultimate truth, as Harvey Gilman reminds us in this week's Friend. So we celebrate diversity, and we celebrate, to a certain degree, uncertainty. But this has consequences for a number of the ways in which our processes work. I think it affects how we are in worship. Are we actually all doing the same kind of thing in meeting for worship? Is it indeed worship anymore? What do we think ministry is? Where do we think it's coming from? We thank people for their ministry. Well, in conservative Quakerism, people are thanked for being faithful for the words that they're given. So where does ministry come from? How do we understand the nature of vocal ministry? And what about meeting for worship for church affairs, our Quaker business method? What happens to that if we have a multiplicity of theologies? Well, it might be fine, but historically, our Quaker business method has been about discerning the will of God with a single clear answer for every question if we can only discern adequately. It doesn't matter who's in the room. If we can discern properly, we will arrive at unity and a sense of the meeting that reflects the will of God. Well, of course, if we don't have a God that has a will, that's a little bit tricky. Or if we don't have a God, that becomes even more difficult. So our diversity can start to unpick the theology that underpins some of our core insights. I'm a little bit bemused, though I'm open to education on this, about why we sometimes have consultations. For example, Meeting for Sufferings recently issued a consultation on whether or not we should revise the Book of Discipline. Well, consultation to me is something that sort of a local council might do. But, you know, Meeting for Sufferings, it has a minute, it has a concern or something that's prompted the question about the revision of the Book of Discipline. And in theory, then, you could discern what to do. But instead, we had a consultation, 109 meetings responded, there was no broad agreement, but Meeting for Sufferings was then able to discern what to do. Well, I wonder whether we might have cut out the consultation and trusted the process that has served us so well for 350 years. About 10 years ago, we minuted that staff who worked for the yearly meeting should not sit on central committees because they might have, quote, a vested interest. Well, I should have stood up and said something at the time, and it was one of my failings in my life of faith. But this is totally bemusing to me, because in a meeting for worship for church affairs where we're setting self aside, as Roy Stevenson told us last year in yearly meeting, there's no such thing as vested interest. Or in fact, are we going to start vetting everybody that goes on a central committee? Any one of us might have a vested interest, but of course it's part of our discipleship that we lay that aside in our discernment processes to seek the will of God. Well, we were told at the time of adopting that practice that it was good practice in the world. And that should worry us, I think, because the world is not attuned to our life of the Spirit. It runs on different rules and different values, most of which we find rather awkward and difficult. So I think our meeting for worship for church affairs is a key area where we're perhaps slightly confused or at odds with each other, depending on our theological position. But it's crucial, in a sense, that we get that right, because that's at the hub of our discerning processes. I think we've lost a sense of the theology of gifts, Spirit-given gifts. Recently, Thomas Swain from Philadelphia has been moving around our yearly meeting, and now Woodbrook is going to be running gifts workshops. But there's this sense where there is that of God in everyone. We know this inherently, deep in our guts. We feel that. And we are all given different but equally important gifts. And when we're faithful to our gifts, that's when we're living our ministry. Well, I think we get confused about this. We take the Spirit-given bit out of the gifts. And we're left with sort of skills or talents. But also, crucially, we're left with a sense that somehow we're all equal and all able and needing to do all things together. So we can run into difficulties this way. We can start to create celebrity, which is a secularization of gifts. We can start to eschew leadership in the fact that no one actually should have any responsibility or any kind of skill to lead because actually we're all equal. Well, we are all equal, but we've also got different gifts. It's not that one's more important than the other, but actually we need all of our gifts to work well as a spiritual community. I mean, we might love that Beatrice Saxon Snell quotation in Faith and Practice, where she's, I think, about to be appointed to be an elder and feels very unworthy and goes to speak to this very wise elderly friend. And the friend says, "Well, my dear, we must take what we can get." Well, we like that. It's very nice, it's, you know, but it's really unhelpful. If we think we're all to do every job just on the basis that the meeting will have to take what it can get. Some people should never be treasurer. It's not where their gifts lie. Other people should be treasurer maybe for longer than 6 years, because that's exactly where their Spirit-given gifts lie. That's their ministry to the meeting. I think we need to reclaim our theology of gifts. And this plays very much into nominations work. Those poor nominations committees, with everyone saying no to them, desperately sometimes ringing round the night before area meeting. You know, we've got this whole kind of tab of things to fill. Huge numbers of nominations. We have more nominations than members. So, spare a thought for those with the gifts of being on nominations committees. Well, nominations committees are trying to match gift and role, not just tick a box. And if we can't find someone in our meeting with that gift, then maybe that job shouldn't get done now. We have these inherited lists of nominations. It may mean, even, that a meeting might need to be laid down for a while. That's okay. My meeting was laid down for 50 years, and today it's thriving. We don't have to just keep going in the face of everything. We've also got a little fuzzy over testimony, in my opinion. It's far more diffuse than it used to be. We used to be very clear. I mean, when I say used to be, I was talking 1880s and before, you know. So I'm quite old-fashioned, really, you know. So by the end of this, you'll think pink dandelion, think tradition. Okay, so. Okay. Well, the peace testimony, as we call it, was part of our testimony against war. War is clear. Being against war, I think, is rather clear to work out what we need to do and when we need to do it. But what does peace mean? Well, it means a whole range of different things to different people. Similarly, we've moved from plainness, no earrings, to simplicity. Well, what does simplicity mean? Does it mean buying the car that will never break down, or does it mean going everywhere by bicycle? And we're back to that sort of private life where, well, we have to decide. We work out what that means for us. So, And we're more permissive about it, not only because we might not know actually how the person's deciding. You know, when I had my lovely Bentley, I mean, the meeting didn't even need to know I had it. You know, I could park it on the other side of town. Go out after Quaker midnight. You know, dark glasses, collar up. Have a little bumper sticker saying, you know, I'm not a Quaker. So. And it was up to me to decide when to tell the meeting that I had this car that did 13 to the gallon. Okay? I mean, it was absolutely lovely. You know. But there we go. So. In the last 50, 60 years, we've developed testimony into a list. So we now have testimonies. We might have SPICE or STEP as a handy acronym. Simplicity, truth, equality, peace. Or simplicity, peace, integrity, community, equality. Well, what does this do? Well, it does a number of things. First of all, it seems to separate out different aspects of our life of faith, as if they're somehow different from each other or unrelated or, worse, optional. Well, I'm strong on simplicity, but I have a trouble with the peace testimony. Well, it's a little bit tricky, you know, I love the car, but I'm really there at the, you know, gates of the airbase. So it also, I suggest, becomes easier for us to divorce our testimony from its spiritual roots. Because here's a little list, and we can pick and choose, and we can just take it as a value or a code or an aspiration and leave behind the spiritual experience that doesn't generate testimonies, but testimony, the faith we're called to lead, the life we're called to lead. I think we're a bit fuzzy about teaching locally. You know, how much we learn about Quakerism and what we learn about Quakerism will depend hugely on which meeting we go to. I mean, what are we going to teach? You know, which part of the diversity are we going to emphasize? And what are we going to say about meeting for worship for church affairs now? Are we going to say, well, it's discerning the will of God? Are we going to say it's discerning the will of God? Are we going to say it's discerning the will of God? So. And if we're a little bit confused or fuzzy internally, what does that do to our outreach? Maybe this is why our badges now say, you know, I'm a Quaker, ask me why, but not ask me what. Or we could have another one saying, just wait till after bath. So. Okay. Maybe we've too much said, we love you. And what is it you would like us to be for you? Rather than saying, we love you and this is who we are. And you're welcome to join if that works for you. I would say that we do love everyone. We want to love everyone. We want to welcome everyone. But that not every expression of spirituality is necessarily Quaker. Not every preference for how we are in meeting for worship is necessarily Quaker. Texting throughout meeting for worship is not Quaker, in my opinion. Okay. And we need to be clear with each other in love. And that will help us be far more exciting and enticing to inquirers who can actually see what it is we are. You know, what is it to be a Quaker? Well, you know, ask the clerk, or here's a book, or, you know, or for me. Always resorting to the individual. And I've done this as well. We resort to the individual. Well, for me, it's like this. Well, we can end up really not answering anything for the other. And it strikes me that there's a huge gap has developed between the clarity and assertion of our book of discipline and how we have been and how we are face to face with people. I mean, obviously, we don't just say, well, read the red book. But we, you know, but we can draw from the Red Book. The Red Book is really very clear about what it means to be a Quaker. It's very clear about what worship is and isn't. It's very clear about what Meeting for Worship for Church Affairs is. It's very clear about the need for a teaching ministry. It's very clear about testimony. But somehow we've left that book on the shelf. And we've developed our own individualized versions and interpretations. So as one friend said to me, whatever we decide to do this week about revising the Book of Discipline, whether or not we revise it, we surely need to adopt it. We need to use it. It's there. It's our Book of Discipline. It's our Book of Discipleship. So we've lost a single voice, I suggest. And we suffer because of that. We've also possibly fallen prey to our own enthusiasm for uncertainty. That the uncertainty that we know is theologically true might begin to unpick any kind of theology. Well, I'm a bit uncertain about this uncertainty. Well, I'm a bit uncertain about Quakerism. Well, I'm certainly uncertain about that passage in Faith and Practice. It's not that we can be uncertain about everything, because we will indeed unpick our beloved society. I think those four core insights about encounter and discernment and testimony and the way we worship, you know, I think it's a dangerous thing to become uncertain about those. They are core insights, in my opinion. And if we lose the spiritual basis, if we lose that sense of spiritual experience that's at the heart of our Quaker faith, then we will simply become a secular pressure group. Or we'll be having a coffee morning on Sundays. Or we'll be a book study group. So, what can we do? Well, we can do whatever we collectively decide to do. Okay? Nothing I've talked about this afternoon cannot be changed. I think we need to resist the secular, resist individualism, and reclaim the spiritual and the spiritual basis of our religious life together, and the joy and the passion that goes with it, and not be beleaguered by the sense of bureaucratic overwhelm that we hear about so often. And there's a couple of examples I'd like to give of things that we might want to put to bed. One is a preoccupation with falling numbers. Now, numbers, whether they're falling or rising, might be of interest to sociologists of religion. And with another hat on, I might be very interested in numbers, and I, you know, have looked at them. But I don't think they take any place in our internal nurture of ourselves as a religious society. We know that statistics are dangerous things. Disraeli said there were lies, damn lies, and statistics. We know that, for example, that trends aren't consistent. Apparently nobody was going to be going to the cinema by 1990 after video came out. Well, now more people are going to the cinema than ever before. You know, so I think, well, what does that mean for Quaker Meeting? Okay, comfier chairs, drinks holders, no, not really, and, you know, a better range of snacks in the foyer. Also, I don't think we want to go down the route where we turn our meetings for worship into cinema. But anyway, there we go. But coming out of that, so first of all, the trend just snapped because something else happened. But secondly, when we have these sort of what I've heard called a doomsday scenario, that there'll be, you know, so many Quakers by 2030. It's not we're suddenly going to, like, lose everybody. We, us, the society, will adapt and adopt new structures as we need to, as we always have. So let's just forget about numbers. It's really unhelpful. And where does a sort of sense of falling numbers fit with a life of faith? It doesn't. It's up here in our heads. We're intellectualizing. So, faith, or hope beyond our imagination, as it says in Romans. You know, it's faith is about what we, you know, can't grapple with up here. So, it's all about the mystery. And we go forward in faith, not listening to the sort of statistical runes of the sociologists. So, now, the other thing I think that isn't very helpful is, you know, and I mean, it does keep the friend in business, which is good, but I mean, this constant dialogue about the detail of the divine. I think we should read Harvey Gilman and then cut a lot of letters to the friend, really. It's again a head exercise. Harvey wrote this week, God is not the name for God. Okay, it's about just trying to find a word that works as a symbol for us. Doesn't mean there's nothing there. And I need to say that very strongly. There is something there. There is spiritual experience at the heart of what we do. But let's not spend a lot of time working on the detail when we've already really decided that that's a rather awkward exercise. And for some of us, that's why we're Quakers and not other things. So, at the same time, and again, Harvey's article is helpful with this, we need to use our own language unapologetically. So we don't want to be pussyfooting around each other saying, well, I mean, last year at yearly meeting, someone sitting on the bench next to me said, I'm going to find it really difficult to report this back to my meeting because I can't mention the term God there. Well, that's, you know, really quite a ridiculous situation to be in as a religious society. Can't we hear the word God even if it's not the language we use? Maybe we're in the wrong place, if that's the case. I think we need to reassert our Quaker processes and our understandings, and I would be waving the red book again, if I'd remembered to bring it. There we go. It's symbolic red book. So, at the same time as reasserting our processes, we may need to sit lightly to some of our structures and all the nominations they involve us with. Okay, there's nothing set in stone. Okay, our processes are important, but our structures are of our making, and they are pragmatic. They've changed dramatically over time, as we can see from the fairly recent introduction of trustees. Trustees for centrally managed work. So we can change things if we need to. And if we need to, then let's do it. Let's not get beset with inertia. And there's a very inspiring story from America of a meeting in Chicago, 108th Street meeting, and they'd reached a nominations crisis, or a labor crisis, if you like. They were just struggling on. And they said, this is just... Nobody was kind of willing really to step up to the plate because there was such a lot involved. They'd seen through these sort of stories of, oh, go on, be Clark. It's nothing really. You know, half an hour a week or something, you know, it'd be all right. You can do it. I know you've only been coming 6 months, but it'll be fine. So they'd seen through that and nobody was going to step forward. And so they had a special business meeting, and they said, well, what do we need for meeting to work next week? Well, they had a building, so they needed someone to open up. Oh, well, I could do that. I can bring the key. And they enjoyed tea and coffee afterwards. Well, I'll bring some milk. That's what it needed, actually. And everyone else could focus on worship and all that that gives us. And they ended up in that meeting with three committees. Us, them, and stuff. Us, well, what do we need to make our meeting work? Well, we need someone to lock up and open up and someone to bring milk. And okay, if we wanted flowers, we'd do that. Okay, so. Flowers are an innovation just from the 1930s, you know. But anyway, that's okay. So, then they had them. So anything that you needed to do with other people, the them committee dealt with it. Okay? And there was the stuff, like the building or getting a new table for the flowers or whatever. So three committees, new energy, new life, and that meeting was transformed. Now, about a decade ago, I moved north, which is why I can say Bath now instead of Bath. I can say either. It's very anyway. So I was shocked actually when I first went to that meeting that I'm now a part of. I'd come out of a rather large meeting in the south with lots of rotas for flowers, rotas for doorkeeping, rotas for library duty, rotas for tea, coffee making, rotas for the person to stand by the piano to ask if there are any questions after meeting. So. And I went to this other meet, and there were lots of nominations as well. Okay? And this new meeting I went to had two nominations a year. Okay? One clerk, one treasurer. And the monthly meeting, as it was then, would supply one elder, one overseer, and a trustee. Okay? No assistant clerk, no assistant treasurer, and no rotas. Whoever gets there first does the job. Okay? If you're by the door and someone's coming along who you haven't seen before, radical as this may sound, you could welcome them. You could open the door for somebody. You could put the kettle on if you got to the kitchen first. If you were thirsty, you would put the kettle on. If there's life in something, you do it. If you're standing around thinking, well, when's this tea coming? Are you really that bothered? No. So it was startling to me. I mean, there's other things about that meeting that are startling, like no notices at the end of meeting. You know, they're sort of monthly. Or, you know, they're put in the middle of tea time if it's really pressing. It's sort of Quaker light. It's a sort of, you know... And it works tremendously well because actually everyone is more involved in the running of that meeting and looking out for each other. Well, who hasn't got a cup of tea? Well, you know, or... So. Okay. So we can do things with our structures. And we can be more inclusive and more welcoming. We can increase the number of children's meetings. I was startled to hear there's only 65 meetings out of our near 500 that have a regular children's meeting that's there every week. So in other words, if a new family come along to a Quaker meeting, they've got to find one of those 65 if they want to be sure that there's something there for their children out of 478. We may not have any children, but we won't have any if we don't have a children's meeting. Okay? We need to have the provision. It may be no accident that out of the 87% of us who come in as adults, the average age is 43. Maybe that's because our children have grown up and now we can go to meeting. So. Okay. So, I've raised a lot of issues, but I want to end with a lot of enthusiasm as well. We have so much in our favor. We have this kettle drum faith. Okay? We have this amazing thing that we can encounter the Spirit directly, feel it in our lives, all of the time, in all places. And that we are, as I said, we can collectively do whatever we are called to do, and we know how to discern what we're called to do. We have huge strengths in our tradition. And we have a lot of good things going on at the moment. We have more people coming in than perhaps any time since the 17th century, 87%. So that's good. Let's get even more people. We have more meetings in Britain than we've just about had at any time, 478. That's surely a sign of growth and strength. We're getting better at communicating, in spite of the fuzziness that I talked about. Quaker Quest has helped us enormously. National Quaker Week gets us practiced at communicating our faith. And I think there are signs of growth in terms of teaching as well. 10 years ago, Woodbrook had about 5% of people in the yearly meeting coming to courses. Now that's up to 14%. And we have new learning programs like Becoming Friends that are working locally. And we've got nobody in the way of whatever it is we want to do. We don't have a pope, and we don't have an archbishop or anything like that. We can actually collectively do what we're called to do. There's no them and us in Quakerism. We're all us. And if we don't like it, we can get involved and help change things. As I say, our only enemy may be our own inertia or our own inability to think radically or to be bold or live adventurously, or a lack of faith, a lack of that hope beyond our imagination. But one of the great strengths that I see is that probably everything I've said here today is not new. In fact, you know, about a year ago, I got the first draft of the book out, and then I read something in the Friend. I thought, oh, well, that's that then. No one has to write that again, you know. I thought, I'll just go home. That'd be okay. But actually, there's nothing new in what I've said. We know these things already. We're already writing about them, discussing them, finding a way through that will be new and powerful and visionary for us, that will nurture our faith and pull together our diversity in a helpful, positive, inclusive, coherent, and dynamic way. We were really, it was suggested by the last year's Swarthmore lecture that we should inherit the tradition. Well, I think we need to inhabit the tradition. We need to live it. We need to have our lives cloaked with our Quaker faith. That everything we do is Quaker. And this is the other difficulty with this, that I have with this, what it means to be a Quaker. Because it's not a Quaker. But it is us as Quakers together, being Quaker. And it's not that we are a Quaker alongside other things, but that our life becomes Quaker. We be Quaker in that sense as well. So, as I suggested as I went through the core insights, transformation is at the heart of what we're about. That we are transformed in order to become agents of transformation, both for those around us and for challenging injustice in wider society and challenging war and the preparation for war. And my prayer is that we can become again kindled into covenantal communities, feeling drawn together, bound together in love and action. That we can again be transformed in order to transform.